Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
This is All the President's Minutes, and I'm your host, Blake Howard. In fact, I'm the producer of all the 1-8 Minute Productions. First and foremost, I just wanted to reach out with my empathy and solidarity for everyone in the United States of America, the African American community, who once again are being forced to riot to be heard in the face of overwhelming and brazen police brutality. When I conceived of this show, I thought that it would be a great landing zone for conversations about cinema, about journalism, about history, and about politics and where those things intersect. The show will go on. However, just some of the episodes that you're going to hear in the coming run of episodes have occurred before any of the events over the last week have unfolded. I once again want to wish my empathy and solidarity from Australia to my American brothers and sisters and to my dear friends, and wish them safety in their protest, in their peaceful protest. And this is not unique to the United States. And any Australian who is listening has to have the morality and the fortitude to acknowledge that this lucky country that I feel guilty for continually saying that I'm lucky that I live in is built on the blood of our own First Nations peoples, and Indigenous Australians continue to suffer the same plight as African American citizens in the United States. And whether it's by agenda or legitimate legal restrictions, Australian press continue to be suffocated. And on this show, we're going to talk about it. Thank you for supporting. Thank you for listening. Let's get into the show.
You are arresting him live on CNN. We told you before that we are with CNN.
If you're just tuning in, you are watching our correspondent Omar Jimenez being arrested by state police in Minnesota. We're not sure why our correspondent is being arrested.
Hang on one second, Allison. Let's listen into what these officers are saying. That is an American television reporter, Omar Jimenez, being led away by police officers. He clearly identified himself as a reporter. He was respectfully explaining to the state police that our CNN team was there and moving away as they would request. And then for some reason, he was just taken in to police custody live on television.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me for the 46th minute of Alan J. Pakula's 1976 masterpiece is a critic that I've admired for a really long time. What she doesn't know is that this is exactly one third through the 138 minutes of this movie. So it's exciting. This is a milestone and a milestone to talk to her. She's a writer and critic for hire, but I've been reading her stuff religiously on the website of the great one, Roger Ebert. So it's my distinct pleasure now to continue to build up a roster of some of the best critical voices in the world on this show and on 1-8 Minute Productions just in general. And she's one of them. Monica Castillo, welcome to All the President's Minutes.
Thank you for having me.
What is
making me blush over here.
Well, if we can only make each other blush in isolation, what else are all these useless Skype meetings, Twitter meetings, and live streams? No, it's a pleasure to get to chat to you. I wanted to ask, what is your relationship with this movie? Because for me, part of my process when I'm talking to different folk for this show is some folk I'm like really targeted that I know kind of what their take is, but some of the folk I want to talk to, like yourself, I don't have any idea of what your relationship is. So sometimes when I reach out, I'm just like, I really like your stuff. I hope that you have a take on this movie, or I hope that you've got a relationship with it, or I hope it's really resonated with you. And so regardless of whatever that is, what is your relationship with All the President's Men?
So it's interesting because I saw All the President's Men. I can't remember if it was in a classroom or a Saturday afternoon, but I remember sitting through it and watching it and thinking like, wow, this is really boring, but it's important. And I'm not quite sure why, but like, I knew that Watergate was a big deal and this is the story behind it. But then when I got more into journalism and I started appreciating more about the work of, you know, investigative journalists and how it's done and the shoe leather reporting and the cold calls, all that stuff, that's when it really clicked for me. And I did a short stint at the Washington Post a few years back. And so they've since moved from that building that it's based on. But like the whole sense and like Ben Bradley quotes on the wall and things like that, like you get a sense of the history still. You're still very connected to some of the people that, you know, their faces are on, you know, portraits and rooms and things like that. Like you don't forget that what they've done. So now it's taken on new meanings for me over the course of my life.
God, it's like you watch it in a classroom and then you're working in the place and it's written all over the walls. It's like, I think that, you know, we make this movie kind of lionizes these guys in the context of America, but in the context of the Post itself as an entity, not the movie, not just the movie, but obviously the movie too. It's like the reputations are all over the place. What was it like? Was it the original newsroom when you walked in, or you walked into the new newsroom? Sorry, just to clarify.
Yeah, the new newsroom. Yeah, this was only a few years ago, so they had already moved.
Not big chunks of paper and filing cabinets and a ridiculous amount of smoking. It's all a very modern version of what we can see.
Oh, yeah. No, they've done away with the smoking, unfortunately. No, and it's a different color scheme, and the lighting is different, and the seating organization is a little bit more spread out. But it is also interesting, too, because I worked at the New York Times as well, so it's a different newsroom culture inside, which I wasn't expecting, but that was also really interesting. But you know, the reporters there are just as competitive, just as, you know, they're always excited to talk about what they're working on. And I saw that in both newsrooms, and I love talking to everyone, not just at my desk. I really enjoyed talking to other people at other desks, finding out, you know, what was going on over on the business side, what was going on over at science, what was going on over at, you know, what are the new developing teams working on? I had, you know, friends across the newsroom, and it was always exciting to kind of swap stories and talk to each other. So that sort of collaborative newsroom environment that you see in the movie and how they, you know, talk to other reporters and things like that, that's very much real. But it also, like, when they have to, you know, sit by themselves and write the story, well, that's very real too.
That's the one thing that I think, anyone who's written online before, like you've had so much of your time writing online and myself too in the writing that I've done, is you just yearn for that. And I think in isolation, it's even more. It's like you just yearn for, like, God, it would be so fun if there was such a publication that you were all in that big room together, just like being able to shoot the shit, throw an idea off of someone. Am I like going crazy here? And just that organic, like, oh, that's it. But obviously still there's the solitary, like, I have to actually write this thing now. So just sit down and write it and file it. There's nothing like a deadline to motivate you. And I think that online, we're also lucky that there's not really, like, there's a deadline, but there's not like a print deadline, like at some of the publications you're talking about.
Oh,
like,
no, yeah,
where there's something that needs to be printed, that is a different animal. It's like you need to have the story now or it's not getting printed at all.
Or you're in real serious trouble. Yeah.
Yes. All that. I guess
I was lucky that most of the stuff that I've done for those outlets have mostly been on the digital side. So I didn't have that much pressure, but there were still a few things that ended up in print. And that's always fun and exciting and also terrifying all at once.
Yes.
You can't, literally, it cannot be changed. It's like, it's done now. It's out of my hands. I think the closest.
That's it. If it's a mistake, get stuck with it.
That's
it. Oh, yeah. And in the movie, when there's a mistake made, they have to deal with it.
Yes, absolutely. It's, and that's what, I mean, it's an unimaginably scary moment. I'm looking forward to who actually gets to tackle that minute head on and talk about what it's like. But it's one of those admirable things of like, there's a digital retraction or an amendment.
Yeah.
It just doesn't
a
work.
Correction.
A correction. I don't know. It doesn't quite hold the same sort of meaning as like literally people knocking on your door and going, okay, well, like you were my source on this story. What the hell went wrong? Like how did the time between us having a conversation about this turn into something that is so completely different?
Right. Yeah. And it's a reporter's worst nightmare for a source to
backflip.
Set you the wrong way or, like, oh, I didn't actually mean it that way or, you know, any which way an interview can go.
Have you had experiences like that being in an interview? Like you're doing a lot of cultural, you do a lot of cultural writing over many publications, both digital, online, and obviously critical stuff. But have you ever had one of those? Because I think that that's probably the closest to pure reporting culture writers like yourself and like in a much smaller way. I'm not your good self, but in a much smaller way, me is like you get the quotes, you interview someone in a podcast, you're writing a piece or it becomes a news item. It's like making sure that you've actually clarified what the heck that person means, and then if you print it, it's not good. It's like, oh god, what's going on here?
Yeah, nothing comes to mind right now, but I'm lucky in that because it is culture writing, most of the people want to talk to me.
Yes.
Every time I watch this movie now as a as a reporter, I get filled with a bit of anxiety, like having to, you know, try to get people to talk to me who don't want to talk to me or who hate me outright. You know, that's a little bit more intimidating than a press day where, like, you know, a filmmaker who's excited to talk about their next project or, you know, an actor who's been working on this role for years is really excited to talk to you. Little less so when you're trying to investigate and potentially, you know, point all the fingers up to the White House.
Yeah, there's another great scene in another very, you know, significant political movie from America, Good Night and Good Luck, where David Strathairn is playing Edward R. Murrow. And there's the difference you see, there's like this massive tonal shift between when they're actually doing proper current affairs and then he's doing like a puff piece with Liberace. And he's like, Lee, and you know, and it's just really beautiful and sweet, and you're like, His posture's changed. He's relaxed. He's got this laissez-faire look on his face. He's like, this is easy. But this tenacity of like calling people endlessly and getting nowhere, like it is an anxiety-inducing thing, especially how many times you have to call on those old rotary phones and get nothing. And that might have been days. Like it could have been days and days and days of that stuff.
Well, when they're looking through the filing cards, and they're like, well, this is not the information. Maybe they misplaced the card. Maybe someone took the card. Oh, crushing.
Because it's like, yeah, they've had to take like hours to go to the library all day. So you get back to your editor and like, how far did you get in the story today? Oh, I went for this lead. What happened? I searched 5,000 cards and it wasn't there. And that is extreme.
That's also not time that we...
Yeah, it's not time we get back.
No, that is... That's not the timeline that we work with in digital now.
No.
Like, this also just looks so luxurious. Like, they had time to look through cars. There's so many stories that I wish I could build out more.
Yes.
And I mean, maybe as a reporter, you always want to do more, add more, keep changing, keep fixing copy. But the actual act of continuing to report out a story, we don't always have that time. We have to finish and move on to the next story.
Yes. Because you've got that, you know, X amount of, you know, even in Oz, at still the sort of big newspaper publications that have any kind of cultural desk, there's like, it may not be inches as it was in the classical sense, but it's usually X amount of stories. Like if you're doing entertainment coverage in any way, you know, it's like, okay, we want X amount of stories today. And so you might have one that is your meaty big story, but then you've still got six other small stories that you've got to file on any given day. And it's like, oh crap, I've got to file all these stories now. And if I'm not going to have hours to luxuriate or days maybe to luxuriate in those interviews. I think that's the only thing that we've got even close is like those big profile pieces that are still, that still come out every now and then. There might be like a GQ or it might be a New Yorker, but they're so like, they're so rare. They just don't seem to pop up nearly as much as they used to.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, but I also really like those.
Yeah,
and I'm jealous as a reporter. I've never had one of those chances where you know, sit and work with someone and talk to someone for over days.
Yeah, Monica, you need one of those. You need one of those like Tom Hiddleston and ones where he talks about Taylor Swift. You know, you need one of those. That was like famously great. That was fun. That's a fun read. Those ones are always really fascinating. Like the time that you get with people in those, you're like, is this a real window into this person, or is it like, have they just put
it on? Is it also performative?
Is it a performative thing? Yeah, they're always great. They're always really good. Part of this podcast can be campaigning for you to get one of those. So we need to get one of those from Monica. Can we please get one of those? who needs the big profile piece for you, Monica? Who's that person that you would like to hang around with for a few days and do one of those enduring pieces?
If I'm really kind of, there's multiple people that I would love to like chat with more than just the 20, 15 minutes that you usually get for a piece. Yeah, there's some that I may even want to do like a book length kind of, just like set through each one of their films, because I know they have stories and I know I've seen them talk about their movies, and I know they could fill a book without even trying. So it's more just like the planets need to align to make this happen.
Yes. We'll let you announce that on your Patreon. For folks who follow, we'll talk about that at the end. We'll follow that at the end of the show. If we get any nice little tiny letter newsletter announcements, that would be a nice little blast to get out of there. That would be great. But yeah, no, I completely agree. I think by the very nature of this project and the projects that I find really fascinating is like scrutinizing something and giving it the air to breathe and the time, medium to medium is one of those massive challenges. Like, you know, I completely agree. You know, when you're talking about taking a filmmaker through chapters of a book, like some filmmakers, you know, and the person that immediately rattled around my mind, someone like a Guillermo del Toro, of someone straight away who is like the chattiest human being about his own films and super articulate. Obviously Michael Mann, is kind of my favorite filmmaker. I can say pretty unabashedly, I think anyone who's listening would know that pretty much.
I was going to say, I didn't know this.
And that's pretty lame for me to mention that now. But someone like that, when you talk to them, you're like, this person thinks so deeply about their art. It just seems impossible. Like you couldn't have, you know, you have an hour with them or you have a chunk of time with them. And you're like, if you just had a few days with them, it would just be transformative. You'd have so much content and they've clearly thought about it in that way. And people who work with them clearly are drawn to the way that they work like that. So yeah, you just always, there's always that. Well, speaking of anxiety and speaking of waiting all day and diverting all of your attention for a story and luxuriating in the time you have to pursue a story, let's take a trip to Florida, or fake Florida as we have in All the President's
Men.
And we're gonna meet Mr. Dardis, and we're gonna see Carl Bernstein harass him after he's just tricked his secretary to get out of the office so he can actually get in there in the office. And we're gonna see a scene that is, I think, from the Nora Ephron, Carl Bernstein script of All the President's Men, because they also had a crack at it in amongst William Goldman. So we've got some good trivia behind that as well. But let's, Monica and I, take a watch of this scene with you guys. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Wait outside?
I've been waiting out since this morning.
Go ahead and finish your call.
Wait outside, please, will you?
No. I'm the reporter from the Washington Post. We talked on the telephone yesterday, and you told me to come on down here, and I'm here.
Okay, I got the press here. I'm going to have to call you back.
You know, if you didn't want to see me, I don't know why the hell you didn't tell me when I was in Washington. I wasted a whole goddamn day here. My paper's waiting for a story. You tell me yesterday, come on down here. You say, I got a 9:30 appointment. I've been waiting out here the whole day.
Caught me on the worst day possible. Yeah. The man I worked for has just started a re-election campaign. Now, we're going to have to see each other tomorrow. Okay?
No, sir, I'm facing the deadline. My paper's saving space for me.
I just don't have a minute now.
I'm sorry,
we're going to have to find...
Mr. Dardis, I'm really very sorry about this. Mr.
I beg your pardon, ma'am, but this gentleman made the appointment with me specifically, and I think that the Washington Post deserves the same courtesy as any of the people you got waiting out there, with all due respect.
I'll have to buzz you in about 5 minutes.
Lady takes good care of me. The fact is, we just can't go into it this evening.
Have you ever been made to watch only 1 minute of a movie before, Monica?
No, this is a first. Usually I'm forced to watch more than 90.
Yeah, at least. It is 2020 all. There's no there's a really great author and friend of mine based in LA. His name's Jordan Harper. He's a writer and a screenwriter and a lot of television screenwriting and teleplays and whatnot. And Jordan's like, if I ever create a film company, it's going to be called Tight 90. That's it. It's just 90 minutes. That's all you've got to tell your story. It's like so many great movies that happen in under 90 minutes. We need to get back to that. We're so obsessed with like longer running times. I said, I'm in for tight 90s.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Ned Beatty as Dardis. God, he's like such a 70s staple. He's got such a wonderful face. I love this scene because every journalist I've spoken to up to this point, so it's exciting to hear you as someone who's worked across, you know, two of the biggest publications in the world and especially done a lot of critical writing for Ebert Voices and whatnot. It's like the thing that all reporters say that you shouldn't do is say, I've got a deadline and this needs to happen right now, because if you are trying to convince someone of like giving you more information that isn't like a politician or isn't someone who is in public office like this guy, sometimes that might scare them, that you're just threatening them with a deadline. Whereas in this scene, Hoffman as Bernstein is like, that is his whole modus operandi in this scene. It's like, you invited me down here, you told me you had the story, I need the story, I got a deadline, we're doing it, and you're going to do it. And it's just that scattergun, fast, manic talking of his in that, like, in the way that he outlays that. It's a really fun little scene. And it has one of my favorite lines ever. Lady takes good care of me.
Which one's that?
Lady takes good care of me. It's such a funny, funny turn of phrase. And he just says it so it's
it is a good throwaway line.
It's such a good little throwaway line. It's great.
Yeah. Hoffman is kind of like a bull in a china shop.
Yes.
He charges in there and he demands respect. I mean, I don't know if I at 4'11 could just waltz into any office like that and demand an interview that way. But he did it and he got the interview. I think that was always something that, like, I'm always in awe of the dichotomy between Woodward and Bernstein, because they're two different type of reporters. They're two different personalities, and that's down, they communicate that down from their clothes to, you know, the way that they handle things in the news, relationships in the newsroom as well. And then you have this moment where you see Bernstein is the veteran reporter, that he knows how to throw his weight around and he knows how to apply just the right amount of pressure to get that interview.
Yes.
And Woodard is he's a younger reporter. He's only been at the Post for 9 months or so that they mentioned. So he's still, you know, still trying to feel his way around the newsroom, still trying to assert himself in certain ways. But he gets other sources and they complete each other in a very beautiful way. And this is just like a very wonderful little showboat moment for Bernstein.
It is. It is exactly that. And some people have talked about the lack of, in this particular scene or in this entire sequence, some people have talked about, oh, it's the least factually accurate moment of like it, that's been translated from the book. You know, there's a couple of things here they talk about, which is that the whole secretary not allowing him into the office and things like that, that was all played up. And I'm like, I think that that's a very fine piece of dramatic license, that a secretary was giving them a little tiny bit of grief to allow Hoffman a moment as Bernstein to do exactly what you said, which is like be a 4'11 person and go into an office and throw your weight around. And when you walk into walk into an office and Ned Beatty is the person that's towering over you, you clearly know that this is two very short guys and they're just having, it's not like a Redford standing there or whatever. But I think you're so right. It's like they're there. He's got to throw his weight around. He's got to be there. And at this time, the Post's reputation is growing as an not just a national, not just a metro paper, but like an international news entity. And so you can see him doing that And I suppose I hadn't thought of it in the way, but I think you put it in a really good way, which is he knows how much weight he needs to throw around with this guy. Because what's really fun about both actors performing as both reporters is they seem to be pretty good. And sometimes they're off, but it only happens sort of early in the film, but they seem to be pretty good at understanding who can take the prodding. Does that make sense? Or do, you know, who can take that, this person needs a little bit more toughness or this person needs a little bit of this. It just feels like that makes really a lot of sense to each of their individual approaches.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a number of scenes where like Bernstein kind of, there's one scene in particular that I'm thinking of, but I'm blanking on the actress's name and her character, but he kind of approaches her with a very like friendly, cordial, sort of conversation, and she jokingly throws back at him like, "Oh, my girlfriend's warned me about you." And the conversation that they have, he still gets information out of her. That's the point of the actual conversation. He's not trying to pick her up or anything, but the whole like just knowing how to talk to people is a skill.
Yes.
And we have
the actress's name is Penny Pizer, because I had the same blank a little while ago. It's Penny Pizer. She plays Sharon Lyons, and she plays a secretary in the White House, and especially around Coulson and Howard Hunt. And they're on top of the Q building in Washington, a great outdoor scene with the planes flying overhead. Yeah. And the power of Dustin Hoffman's flirtatiousness is extremely strong in that moment. It's extremely
strong.
Extremely strong.
And that is not the energy that he uses to approach Ned Beatty.
But oh, we could imagine, Monica, what that would be like if it was a flirtatious approach.
I don't
approach.
Think it would have gone over well.
No.
Or not as well.
Not as well.
Yeah.
No. Funnier in memory, but not as well. But no, it's a really interesting, it's really hard because especially the entire duration of the minute that we're looking at, it has been one of those, I guess, frustrating sequences that happens over and over in this movie, and they kind of become this addictive frustration where they hit a roadblock and you kind of watch them push against the roadblock, and sometimes there's a breakthrough and like what is about to happen in the upcoming piece of this scene, and other times it's just exactly as we talked about just prior to the break was, you know, those moments where you search through 5,000 cards and there's nothing. You're like, maybe someone took them, maybe they're gone. Whatever. So that's really good because it's one of those scenes that becomes addictive on repetition. And just for folks who are listening, just that there is a little bit of lore and revisionist history that goes around the script of All the President's Men. So if you look at the final shooting script or the final iteration from William Goldman, there are versions of the script that they don't quite match up. They don't sync perfectly with the film, and if you, unlike Monica and myself, who might be a little bit more familiar, it doesn't. If you look at the final draft of a script, that is very rarely what you see on the screen. There's always like a shooting script. There's amendments. There's usually line changes, that depend on the actor, depend on the director in that moment. Maybe they improv a line that's better. And so sometimes when you see a published script, it actually incorporates all of those things. Whereas in the final version of the script, as they take it to be shot, can be slightly different. But in this particular scene, Carl Bernstein and his then girlfriend Nora Ephron had a crack at the script, and this scene was apparently stayed completely intact from that script and moved straight from their version of it, like their adaptation, and went into Goldman's script. It's like the only scene that is, I guess, wholly not Goldman and Holdley, those two. And I've always thought of it as like it kind of completely underpins and sinks in what you just said is like, this is the showboat scene of Bernstein, and it's the sort of centerpiece of his power in the middle of this movie. And it makes no surprises that someone who was seeing him at the time maybe crafted that perfect scene to show off what his skill was as a tenacious reporter in the middle of a movie.
Or that
like
he crafted it himself.
Yeah, I suppose we might give
we give
Ephron the credit as the writer. But look, I like that he basically dictated that would be the scene. This is the scene, honey. This is how I did it. This is it. This is great. You know, I was so fantastic in this moment. This genre of films, paranoia thrillers, really sort of emerged in the New Hollywood era or in American cinema around, you know, the 1970s. I think it happened a little bit earlier if you go to European cinema. There was, existentialist paranoia, post-war stuff that happened closer to the end of World War II, because I think people in Europe had the war kind of rubbed in their faces in a much more extreme way. So you can sort of trace some cinema back to then. But then it reemerges in the 90s in America as well. There's kind of like this corporate, the government was replaced with sort of corporate entities and messing around. You get the Aaron Brockoviches and you get The Insiders and you get those sorts of films. What is paranoia cinema a genre that you're into, or is it a journalism genre that you kind of are drawn to? Like when you're thinking about movies like All the Presidents, is what's the genre that you kind of have the biggest relationship with?
That's a good question. I think the journalism genre has just now become a bit more ingrained in me, just because now I do have those experiences. I have talked to political reporters. I have had friends in the field, and I do have friends who are in the White House press corps.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. And right. And then like there's feelings in that, you know, I worry about them. I I'm always watching and rooting for them. And, you know, it's sometimes always intense. Some of those press conferences, I can't watch them, but I hope that I will wait for the highlights and I will see if my friends get a question in. But it's, you know,
and I was gonna say your friends absolutely would hit close to home. I was just gonna say, and just checking in to see that your friend hasn't been drawn into some latest meme of the president or one of his representatives saying something outlandish based off of a question that they say, and then it turned into like a swarm of online stuff. That is, yeah, the proximity of that is crazy. How do you as a friend, because I know that I know on a much smaller scale, if I've got friends who do like news segments or they're journos and they do good stuff, you sort of give them a text or a tweet DM or your WhatsApp or whatever it is, and you sort of check in, or sometimes it's a phone call. Oh, that was really awesome. You should be so proud. That like worked really well. How is stepping cautiously with friends who are in the White House press corps? Is it just like are you okay? Like, is there sort of a stock standard message that goes to them and says, hey, how is it? Are you all right? How was today? How was that? Because it's not getting any easier for those guys.
Oh, it's not. No. And actually, even before all of the coronavirus stuff started happening, I've been really interested in talking more about how members of the press are dealing with stress, especially with being targeted by trolls, by harassers. We're not really talking about how members of the press are being harassed on the job. Just by, you know, trying to do their work, and now people are attacking them or threatening them. I've heard stories of journalists getting their photos taken and having them posted on websites targeting journalists. So it is a lot more scarier in those senses. I think for me to check in, it tends to be little by little. Sometimes it's usually maybe when I just meet up with them at a convention or a conference, because I usually end up going to a few journalist events in New York City. I mean, we have so many different groups that get together. And that's usually the time where I'll ask, like, hey, how are things? You doing all right? And then usually, like, when they do a great piece, or I see that they've asked a wonderful question, whatever it might be, I will retweet, I will support, I will, you know, give the share.
All that good stuff, yeah.
Absolutely.
Bumping them up when they get that profile. Yeah, just feels hard. It's one question that this whole project is, this whole project continues to bring up is, and sometimes it's funny, like, what would Nixon be like if he had Twitter? It's fun. That's hours of wondering for me in the last 6 months.
Chaos. It's just chaos.
Absolute ludicrous. Especially towards the end, you just go, okay, this could have been really fun. But definitely around, you know, there is the increased, the increased scrutiny and focus on, especially the stakes of this story, the increased focus on everything being so right and having multiple sources and knowing the stakes of what they're reporting, especially in these newsrooms. And it still happens. You know, I've been really lucky to talk to lots of journalists such as yourself that have been on here, whether it's culture journalists or real, you know, quote unquote, like political journalists, business journalists. And the level of scrutiny doesn't really change in big publications. They're very intensive and they want everything to be completely fact-based. And I think that that's one of the whole contemporary fallacies that's been drummed up by, you know, propagandistic rants from people in the public eye, like everything's non-fact based and everything's an attack. It's like, no, these people are like researching and they have editors who check what they're doing, and if they don't like the tone, they make them change it. And in big publications, that's what it is. But I think also about the anonymity, so to speak, of these guys being able to just be junior journalists, I guess you would call them, junior in the overarching hierarchy of the paper, who can go out and ask questions, and even though their names start to become aware of, like, you imagine that now they would be targeted directly before, long before, not just from like a bad social media post, but like, you know, a conflicting, if Fox News is around when those guys are reporting on Watergate, like, can you imagine their names and their faces being on the news and them becoming part of the story long before it happened, if you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And the moment where they get the story, not when they kind of mess it up or they don't get it as tight, and everyone, you know, jumps on that, then, you know, that becomes its own sort of media circus. That's certainly a moment where, you know, the whole outlet might have been discredited. I do think about that a lot. And it's funny too, rewatching this movie, I thought about that in particular scene. And any time that there's so much as a solid question asked of the current administration, how it automatically becomes like, that's a nasty question, or some sort of different deflection technique. I immediately thought of all of that. All of those thoughts came rushing back when I was seeing those scenes and had, you know, the multiple different denials all down the line. It's like, oh gosh. Yep.
And the beautiful... and the beautiful non-denial denials as well, where it's just like, that's nasty. Right. Where they're just not even answer. You know, that's nasty. Right. They're not even answer. It's not even an answer. It's just a comment on what the question was. And you're like, that's actually the refreshing thing. And it kind of sometimes goes past.
But they check the reporters too, because they do make some comments about Ben Bradley.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. But there's what's refreshing in All the Presidents is a couple of times where you catch the guys watching a television segment, and one of the people that's interviewing a political party and it's going, well, this is reported in the Post. And there's a moment where they're asking a question and they're following the political line, and she goes, no, you didn't answer my question, but I asked, did you know about what the Post reported? And then he's, no, I did not. And you're like, oh, isn't that nice? And like a journalist just had like, you know, allowed the airtime to pursue a question and rigorously follow it up and it not get cut off and not get dissuaded. It's like, no, you're here to answer my question. That's the whole point. If you want to say something, we're going to respond to it. I'm going to make you try and be accountable for the answer. This scene is this scene is like a pretty pretty bright, pretty sunny in his office sort of an exchange that is not like necessarily like the most formally blowing you away scene in this movie. I know that you as a culture writer have talked like about, you know, great formal technicians and filmmakers whose craft is actually the elevating thing. It's not necessarily the content of their work, but it's just the craftsmanship. You know, have you got like a past with Alan J. Pakula? Do you like his films? Are you fond of what he does, or Gordon Willis, or those craftsmen who are like bringing this movie? When you're watching it, what's your experience with just the pure tech, like the technical craft of what's happening in both this minute, but more broadly, probably better to help you enunciate that in the whole of All the President's Men?
I need to continue on my Alan Pakula kick, because I finally got around to Klute within the past year.
Great.
And really enjoyed that movie. And now I want to complete, you know, the Paranoia trilogy. Surprisingly enough, I'm a big Warren Beatty fan, but I've not gotten around to the Parallax View. It's just like, I got to do this. It's time.
You got it. And if, I think you've got Criterion. If you've got the Criterion channel, you got to jump straight on that. I think it's on Criterion channel. I know Clued is, but yeah, I think they had the whole trilogy kicking around there for a little bit.
Yeah.
Parallax is wonderful.
I'll definitely check it out. Like Gordon Willis, certainly, he was like one of the first cinematographers whose name I learned way back before I even knew I wanted to be a film critic. I just knew, like, I liked the look of a lot of his movies, and a lot of the movies I happened to like also had him as a cinematographer. But this is so interesting because it's so not a Gordon Willis looking scene.
No.
It's, like you mentioned, very sunny. When I watched it, I kept thinking, like, they're trying to make this seem like Florida. So they have a huge, like, floor-to-ceiling windows that's very bright, letting a lot of natural light in. But I noticed watching it, and I was just watching it on my laptop, not like any big screen or, you know, fancy restoration or anything, just whatever was on Amazon. I noticed that there were hills in the background.
Yes.
And I'm originally from Florida. There's no hills in anywhere in our state.
There is no hills.
And then that's when I was like, oh, that's right. They're filming this in Burbank.
This is Florida via Burbank, just like, but unfortunately, you know, fortunately the budget is clearly on bringing the entire Washington Post newsroom into a Burbank bunker on the Warner lot. It's one of those things where like, great craftsmanship in the 70s when it's on 35mm print on a big screen stretched out does not do wonders for you when you get a digital transfer on high definition anything.
No.
Like it's one of those things that kind of goes, this isn't Florida. There's no hills.
No.
Maybe.
No hills.
There's no hills.
The palm trees are a nice touch.
Yeah. The palm trees are funny because I look at them, I had the same response. I never noticed the hills. I'm actually going to go back in this scene and go and find them and see where they are because that's hilarious.
Oh, nice. I noticed that for you.
It's always great to pick up new stuff. But the palm tree bit cracks me up because I just imagine like someone in production, okay, we need to go out and you need to just surround this phone box that's probably on the Warner lot with palm trees because that, of course, means that we're in Florida.
Well, and I don't know because California does have palm trees around and people planted those. So they could actually already have been on the lot. Maybe they were just ordered a bit. But it's also the palm tree insignia also like goes into the Dade County police sheriff or police crews. They have that on their badge and they have it on their, you know, the county logo behind the secretary. Like they really tried to, you know, sell the illusion that this was Dade County, Miami.
For just a minute. And look, when you're shooting indoors, you know, the Washington Post newsroom was scary. It was scary to Bradley. It was scary to Woodward and Bernstein, who were consulting on set and around going, God, like you guys did everything. The waste in the waste paper baskets are shipped from the Washington Post. Like they were that obsessive, but you can't do everything. But yeah, it's really funny that you say you had a relationship with Gordon Willis because I'm the same. Like long before I knew really about cinematographers just in general, I like could say, you know, five or six movies off the top of my head that I loved the look of, and they were all him. And so then you go, hold on.
Yeah.
What is this? Hold on. That's not right. And then you go back and
I got to meet Gordon Willis.
You did.
He was at a screening at the Harvard Film Archive. And this must have been, it was before I even started writing about film. But they were I think it was just a tribute to Gordon Willis. And they had a screening of Manhattan and it was a print. And I went with a friend and we went to see it and they had a wonderful Q&A with him afterwards. And he was there in the lobby and I just went to introduce myself. And it was super exciting to just, you know, get to tell someone like Gordon Willis, like, I'm a fan of your work. Even though I'm sure a million people have done it, you know, it's still kind of cool to be able to fan out over someone's work like that.
Yeah, like a practitioner like him too, because I think for a stack of cinematographers, they kind of go stylistically unnoticed and you get the big names, you get the Deakins and, you get the Willises and you're like, they're the guys or the Chivos that are around there. You know, they sort of they sort of pop up now and then. It feels like one every decade that is like the guy. That would have been amazing. And what did he have anything to say in that Q&A about all the president's men or about his career, about his approach? Did he have anything to talk more generally about, like especially even Alan Pakula, because they had such an amazing relationship?
Unfortunately, I only went to the Manhattan screening, so most of the questions were just geared towards that movie.
Yeah,
but it was really interesting because I'm blanking on the gentleman who did the actual questions, but he, you know, was trying to do this very nice, very Harvard academic approach to cinema, that's very flowery language, long paragraphs worth of questions. And Gordon Willis was very much a straight shooter. You know, he maybe had like 3 to 4 sentences tops per answer, but he got to the point and he told you what he was thinking. A lot of it just, it happened to be that way. And he decided to shoot it this way. And he just was so decisive that he just knew this was going to happen. So I think the big question that I remember was a long kind of drawn out, like, okay, so the bridge scene in Manhattan is such a big famous one. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to shoot it from this angle? Why did you decide to do all this stuff? Was this, you know, something storyboard, you know, all this other like possible answers. And then he just answered very matter-of-factly that they had asked the city of New York to leave the lights on a little longer. And then one side of the bridge had lights and the other side of the bridge did not. So then they decided to move it a little bit more to angle it, so it looked like, both sides. The whole was lit. And they shot it that way. It was an accident.
it's like, it's the same as the big Library of Congress scene. It's not in the script. Like with the camera movement, it's not in the script.
Oh, it wasn't.
It's a Pakula Willis decision of like, how are we going to make this happen? And then they only had like a couple of shots at it. They just put like a pulley with an old school camera, like very slow, like a pulley and a lever to steady it as they went up, like this sort of natural, vertical. And it's one of those things. Like I think that, but like you said, there's such a decisiveness sometimes with those artists that they just look at it and they go, I know how to fix, like they've just got a great eye anyway, but they're like, I know how to fix this and how to practically do it. You see it a lot with really great candid photographers as well. They just sort of find ways that they get themselves in position to make things perfect. Like that, I think there's a great spectrum. There's artisans who storyboard the living daylights out of things, and you get lucky with certain artistic directors. And I think, one of them, I think, is like Ridley Scott. He famously does these gorgeous storyboard sketches in car rides, like to his set. Like he's like, I want to shoot it like this. And like comes hand in glove with like things he's sketched that are like beautiful, that could be in a comic book or something like that. They're just gorgeous. Whereas something like that, it's really cool to hear him just go, no, this is like how we made it work. It's how we made it work to tell the story. And it just so happens that he's like extremely visionary in his decisiveness of like, this is how it has to work. And he just happens to be a bit of a visionary, but it doesn't ever seem like it's hard work for him.
Yeah. And I mean, we could discuss about any number of movies it's so obvious. Like, he saw things that people didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you'd only ever, in my mind, and you'll definitely see this in something like Parallax View, because Parallax View has more of this, there's more overt paranoia cinema language, like dwarfing of people, and there's a real red color theme in the film, and I think that you'll get a real kick out of it as a Gordon Willis fan. And anyone, if you haven't seen Parallax, it's just great because it is just much more, it's more anchored in like abstraction and things being ambivalent, because obviously here you've got a factual text that they have to adhere to tell the story. And I think that was part of the purpose, but Parallax, they get to go a bit off the wall. And I love Beatty and he's great. He's really excellent. But one thing I was going to say to you was that if you'd only ever made Parallax for you, or only ever made The Godfather, or only ever made Manhattan, just as an individual thing, that would be like the jewel of the crown. But when you make them all, it's just like it's like something else. It's something
within relatively short succession of each other. Yeah,
yes. Yeah, like a bunch in a row makes them all absolutely incredible. What's your favorite part of this film?
Oh. Oh, that's hard. There's a number of really great scenes. But I think for me, the part that I really like is the chance to see Woodward and Bernstein work together.
Yes.
To actually see.
I'm sorry, like, I gave you a scene with just one of them. I wish I'd known before.
No, it's good, but it was a really fun scene, and I appreciated the Florida connection. That's actually my home state. So I thought you did it on purpose. No,
well, I'm
but
just gonna,
I
I'm just going to cut that right out and say that I did on purpose, because no one would ever notice. No one would ever notice as quickly. Then people will believe it too, because no one ever noticed as quickly as you that there were hills in the background of that scene. You're like, that is 100% not Florida. This taking me out of this scene completely.
Yeah. Yeah, I never actually saw hills or mountains until I was my shoulder. I was a teenager probably before I saw the Smokies.
Oh, my God. Amazing.
Yeah. No, but the chemistry between those two actors and the characters, how they complement each other, just in almost every facet. I think I was geeking out about that before, rewatching it and just noticing, like, there's so many stains on Dustin Hoffman's costume. Like, I almost wanted to watch it. Just watching it, because it's like there's coffee stains where there shouldn't be coffee stains. How does he have them so far up his sleeve? Someone cleaned this child. And then you have Robert Redford.
That's like my son when it's like my son and daughter when they eat pasta. There's any time they eat pasta, God, it's just like, how did you get it? How did you get pasta in your hair? How? I don't understand.
How old are they?
I've got a nearly 2 year old now, and nearly 3.5. So the 3.5 year old, she's very good. It's only sort of by accident, if she's not paying attention, she might scratch her head or something like that, and she'll get some. But she's better. The boy is he's a mess. It's like a savage. He can't be stopped right now. So yeah, he would probably look like Dustin Hoffman in this movie after a meal. I think about his jacket all the time, and just how many ash, like it's like a, it looks velvety, the jacket, like the texture of it. And you always see the ash, the cigarette ash.
Corduroy, no?
Like corduroy or velvet or something. It's like that material that it's like absorbs ash all over his jacket. It's great.
There is one scene where Bernstein like taps out his cigarette, and it's on the couch of the main editor of Ben Bradley's office, and it's Woodard who like brushes it off the couch. It's like, what? It kind of is like the two different personalities: the really uptight, clean one. It's the odd couple dynamic. Like, it's just really fun to watch play out in a very serious drama.
Yeah, they are definitely the odd couple. They work so well together. And it's also, again, just little touches. They were just so intimately aware of each other's lines. They knew things they could interrupt each other and vamp. And I think that's what I marvel at in their performances, is how different they are. And then that chemistry and that whatever that alchemy is of them knowing each other well enough of exactly how to complement and stay contrasting. Like, they're just contrasting each other and stay together in the scenes, be there and be organic, but also be so true to each other. I think it's pretty marvelous, both of them together.
Yeah.
And such a good choice, right? Because like Redford, as a producer of the film, has to choose someone who's an absolute powerhouse, and to have it's really cool when you see actors, there's so many stories and you would know so many of them, both contemporary and sort of the great stories in our history of cinema, of like there's one great actor and they won't cast another big actor alongside them. Or in the modern times, it's like if we're getting into a fight, we have to have exactly the same amount of punches with each other. Just the ridiculousness that happens in modern times. But it's so cool to be like, no, I'm going to get like the other, like one of the biggest movie stars in the world, and we're going to just play off each other and we're going to see how it goes. And that is just everything.
Yeah, I actually just watched the ECM conversation back in 2011. And just getting to revisit those stories and just what he was talking about. In one segment, he was talking about the moment about Lion and Winter, and how both he and Katharine Hepburn were cast. And she had kind of made a joke / serious call to make the movie, and she wanted to make the movie with him. And he said that he didn't think he was quite ready. He was still too young. Like, this is a more experienced age actor for that role, for either, I believe it's Richard, one of the Richards. I can't remember now. That's I saw it at 9 o'clock this morning. But she she said that, do it now. I can't remember exactly the line, but she told him to do it now. And he decided, all right, she said to do it now, I'm going to do it now. And then it's like one of the best performances. Again, two powerhouses just, you know, matching on screen so incredibly, and just makes for riveting movie to watch.
Monica, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. And not only is it awesome to know that we've had a journalist that's worked in the Post and the Times and Ebert voices at such as yourself, but also who can spot hills in the background of Burbank's fake Florida faster than any human being that has ever been on this show. So it's just a pure pleasure to chat to you. And the best place for people to find you, as they'll hear in the wrap, is Twitter at @mcastymovies. But look, just it's a treat talking to you, and it's lovely to meet you, and thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for the incredible Monica Castillo at @mcastymovies, MCASTIMOVIES. You can find all of the links to her great stuff at a variety of publications there, and also links off to her Patreon, which is patreon.com/mcastymovies. Thank you so much for being part of the show. It's an honor to have you on, Monica. And folks, thank you so much for listening. We're increasing the output of all the President's Minutes right now because this is the time to have conversations about not giving up, about truth to power. And it feels like a responsibility if this show is to continue to have a dialogue, to have a robust dialogue about the intersections of journalism, of cinema, of history, and of politics. Thank you so much for continuing to listen. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes very soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.